Live. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. I'm your host as always. I haven't said that in a while, and Steve's not here to fuck with me, so he used to always mess with me. If you listen back way back in the early episodes of like, 20, 30 something, he used to get so mad at me because every time I'd intro, I'd go, welcome to Cognitive Rampage. I'm your host as always, and it was terrible. It took me a while to get over that. So, but anyway, I'm sure you guys didn't want to know all that. But we have a group that's on Facebook. I know not everybody's on Facebook, but it's a group that we all call the Tribe of Change. And we started this group a long, long time ago, not too long ago, and it's grown so quickly. And there's so many amazing, cerebral people in this tribe that I've just met from all over the world. That I've gotten a chance to interact with, see the stuff they're into, watch their posts, that kind of thing. And I made a change like months ago when I said that, you know, I would bring on the podcast people from the Tribe of Change, you know. And I love to stick to that. And I've met so many amazing people through that tribe. And, you know, we shared actually a close friend of mine, Chris Beckemeyer, a member of the Tribe of Change. Shout out. Happy birthday to you today, man. He was one of the first tribe members to come into the Cognitive Cave and share a very personal story of battling and overcoming addiction in his way, and how he chose to, and what he stands for, and how he helps people today. And happy birthday to you, Chris, man. I'm glad you're able to turn that around. But my point is Chris is one of the first tribe members to share a story, a life story that encompasses addiction and overcoming that. And Shannon Haggerty, welcome to the show, man. And I appreciate you coming on and tell the story.
Thanks, man. Good to be here.
Yeah, see, we were talking pre-show. If you watch this live on Facebook, I always do like a pre-show on Facebook and like before we go live. I was trying to pronounce your name, and then you were saying it much cooler with the Australian accent, and you did it.
Come Haggerty? On.
Yeah, there it is. See? Yeah. See, that's so much. I'm serious. America, like, it's rare. Like, you don't have there's not like a center, an accent. There's nothing. We're just kind of flatlining, man. But anyway. So from what, you know, from where we caught up just before we came on the show, you were telling me that, you know, you have a gym opened up here and you're trying to get back home to Australia, right? That's where, not trying, but you're headed back home to Australia, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And for those that are either new to the Cognitive Rampage or what we talk about and people that are involved, is Functional Patterns is involved. And this is basically, you run a personal training gym where you utilize functional patterns and methods to help people.
Yeah, mate, that's right.
All right. Yeah, I'm kind of summing through that because, you know, we talk a lot of functional patterns on here. But for me, I kind of wanted to place the present for people, you know, that are listening about where you are, you know, presently and get through that. But just kind of, if you would kind of, you know, maybe tell us where you come from, where it started, a brief history, and kind of lead us into, you know, how you got to where you are now.
All right, mate. I grew up in Australia, a small country town called Mackay. Beautiful place. It's not unlike Florida, actually. It's very, very similar. You know, the further north you go, it's kind of like the further south you go here. It gets very tropical. Mm. And anyway, when I was 17 years old, I went to Sydney and started playing professional rugby league. So that's what I used to do.
Gosh.
And
that is a fucking sport. Oh, my Lord. Now, I mean, I watch, you know, I played football a while and a long time. I never got a chance to play rugby, but I watched that. And I'm like, shit, that's some brutal stuff, man.
Yeah, it definitely does a lot of damage to the body.
Yeah, how long did you play?
Professionally for 12 years, but I've been playing since I was 5 years old.
Holy, that's shit. You're talking, what, 20 years of basically MMA fighting every couple seconds?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. MMA fighting with automobile accidents in between.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shit, what kind of, I can only imagine the kind of damage over time, man. What, with any serious injuries over that kind of time?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. I've had about 10 different surgeries, like kind of over that 12 year career. And hey, my body just wouldn't take it anymore. I got to the point, I hit 30 years old. I was a mess, physically, mentally, and the body just wouldn't hold up to it anymore. So I decided to give it away.
How hard was that, man, letting that go?
It was hard, and I think ever since I was a kid, that's all I wanted to do. Teachers would ask me, what do you want to do? I'm like, I want to play professional rugby league. That's what I want to do. And as you get older, they keep asking you the same questions, and then you keep coming up with that same answer. Kids are like, I want to be a policeman. I want to be, I want to be a fiery. And kind of changes as you get a little bit older. People start saying, I want to be an engineer and get more specific. But that's all I ever wanted to do. And so that's where I directed all my energy and focus into. So, yeah, man, it's been a wild ride.
Yeah, I talk a lot about the athlete's depression, sculpting an athlete. I didn't realize that when you were coming on. I had no idea you had played for so long professionally. And did you, I'm just jumping right in. Did the addiction kick in after rugby was over?
No, I mean it was definitely there. During my career, I think as towards the end of my career, it just got worse and worse. I guess when you see the end coming, and you kind of got to let go of whatever or whoever you thought you were, then you just kind of, I guess I was just trying to fill whatever hole was getting deeper and deeper and bigger and bigger. So it progressed far worse, as I'd finished my career. I mean, I think that I know, a lot of my teammates and a lot of other people as well that that play the sport and any other sport. I think there's those few years when you finish your career, you kind of, 2 or 3 years where I guess you've done something all your life and you're pumped up to be this person. I guess you kind of manufacture an ego, really. That's pretty much what I was. Just walking, talking, full of shit ego. And when that was done, when I didn't have that status anymore, then it was like, who the fuck am I? So that was very, very daunting.
Yeah, well, when we're sculpted as kids to be that thing, and we are that, and excuse me, and we become that. I mean, that defines us. That becomes who we are. And then when we don't play anymore, we literally kind of lose who we are.
Yeah, exactly.
And now, in dealing with injuries over the 12 years, is that kind of how maybe it crept in? Because I mean, I know to play that long, you got to be on some serious pain meds, man.
Yeah, definitely. That was definitely part of it. I don't think that's what made me an addict. I think that's just, I was always an addict. It would just depend on what triggered what, whatever it was to set me off, down that path. Because I was always very anti-drugs, for the first 20 or so years of my life, and then once it started, that was it. It was all on. And but definitely towards the end of my career, like I was in a lot of pain, a lot of surgeries, and I, just easy access to it. And so you start taking it. It was funny the first, it was took me a while to realize that that's what the problem was, that I was actually addicted, because I was just taking pain meds to play, so I wasn't, had some back injuries, and I would just keep taking them and taking them. And then I'd kind of like lead up to the game and I'd come off them and I'd be like, okay, I don't, I'm not going to take them a couple of days out. But then I'd get real sick, the day of the game.
Yeah.
And I didn't know why. I just didn't click, because I didn't really know much. I didn't know much about addiction. I think, you think about addiction and you think of, someone laying in the park with a needle in their arm, or or a crack addict or something like that. It never dawned on me that's what it was. And so I think that's what, I mean, that was part of the big problem, was I didn't even know. And then by the time I knew, it was just, I was kind of stuck in that cycle.
Was there a rock bottom moment? Was there a time where you said, man, this is it. This is where I got to make a change? Or how'd the change start with you?
The change came about I've been clean sober just over 4 years. And I think the change was, it wasn't, you wouldn't think, I mean, I guess my financial rock bottom like happened just over 5 years ago, or maybe 5 years ago. I just lost everything that I ever earned, playing rugby. And, and it was pretty good money. It's not the kind of money that you guys make over here, for your professional sports, but it was, it was good.
Mm-hmm.
And, I had some properties and whatnot. And then, as it does with addiction, everything just starts, everything falls away and everything gets taken away. And, it doesn't get taken away, you give it away. So, financial rock bottom. I was pretty much living in my car before I came over here. Came through customs with a dirty bag of clothes, and that was it. That was pretty much it. So, I think, I still, it still went on for a little bit longer while I was here. And then after that, it wasn't the point where I couldn't stop taking something. It was like this or the other, or maybe I can just take this and not that. Just not the case with me, personally. I just, whatever I'm, if I love something, that's it. I love it. It's like fitness, It's like FP. It's like all that kind of stuff. If I love it, I'm all in. I'm not putting one foot in and one foot out. I'm just hammering it. And I throw everything into it, like rugby as well. So, I think it just got to the point where I was put in a situation where someone was asked, someone very close to me was asking me, questions of, whether I was using something. And the fact is that I didn't need to lie. I think this person would have been okay with it. But the fact that I just couldn't be honest, and be truthful, to this person that was very important in my life, I couldn't do it. That's what made me kind of look in the mirror and say, you can't keep living like this. I can't, it was just bad for my soul. My whole spirit was broken, and it was just a mishmash of, I was just a mess, an absolute mess. And just the fact that I couldn't be honest with someone that I said that I loved was the wake up call for me. A lot of other, bad shit happened, in the lead up to that. But I think that was the point where I was like, I can't live like this anymore.
What was the first thing you did in the first few months?
Pardon?
What were the first things that you did the first few months as you kind of made the change?
As I made the change, I sought outside help, going into a 12-step program. And I would just go to meetings every day because I just didn't know how to. I kind of surrendered and said, I just don't know anything about anything. Like my whole, basically everything that I knew had to be thrown away. It had to be thrown away. Everything, who I thought I was, anything that I was holding on to. And it took a while, but it was funny, especially for the first few months at least. My thinking was so messed up, or I just didn't know, I had no idea what was up and what was down, that if I had a reaction to something, my first reaction to something, I would like do a George Costanza and do the opposite. And that would usually be the right thing to do, or I'd have to like really sit there and think about it and kind of process it. So it was just, rewiring how I process things, my reactions to things. Because I think, me personally, my reaction is, or has been, so there's kind of no reaction, there's an underreaction, or there's just a complete overreaction, and there's no in between, there's no midline where the reaction was. So that's something that I've had to learn to do, over the last few years, and it's definitely getting better. The longer and longer I stay, sober and clean, and then the more I learn, the more I'm able to soak up
So for 4 years, you know, obviously you made a lot of changes. You moved, you know, from Australia to here. And I mean, that was part of changing a huge environmental change. So you make big environmental changes. Well, I mean, did you make social changes? Did you remove yourself from certain people? I mean, how far did you go to remove yourself from everything?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't associate with anyone that I kind of knew within my first 6 months to, you know, 12 months here. Like even people that really didn't have anything even people that I wasn't a danger around, or they, you know, they weren't really dangerous to me. I just completely changed everything. Didn't go out much. I still don't go out much because, you know, I think the further you get along, then it's just like, you know, going out doesn't interest me at all. You know, hanging out with my friends, you know, close people that I've been lucky enough to meet along the way. That's fun to me. So, just finding a whole, like, I guess, you know, when you're I guess in football, or I guess in any kind of profession, when you're put into that situation, when you're around those people, you want to be, you look at the most successful people, you know, you're kind of figuring who they are and you want to be like them, or you kind of want something that they have, you know, there's some kind of trait that attracts you to them. So, you know, I did that with, you know, a lot of people that I met. I think the luxury of not being, you know, back in Australia was I was able to pick my new friends and who I wanted to be, or who I wanted to let in. And that, I think that's really been a great thing. It's been a great thing to do, because I'm able to attract people like that, because then that attracts more people like that and more people like that. And it's really how I was able to create this gym that I have now. Just bringing in people with good vibes, good people, and then in turn they attract more and more people as well. So it's a really good vibe in here, and the egos are very limited, which was always my ego was always that was a big downfall of mine. I think it's a big downfall for a lot of people, but, you know, speaking, I can't speak for everyone, but personally, that was definitely one of my downfalls, or a big part of it. That's what I had to basically kill off, was the ego.
As you came out of, you know, the recovery place that you went to and the 12 steps, as you were utilizing that, did you build this gym along the way? Were you training people one-on-one? I mean, how did you build the gym that you have now?
I was training people at parks, go to their houses. I didn't have a gym. I wasn't in a gym for about maybe 3 years. And I was just doing a lot of outdoor training. That was something that a lot of my friends back in Australia were doing. You know, people like to be outside, you know, it's organic, fresh air. So there was always that. And then one day I just decided that, you know, I saw a lot of my friends opening gyms up and whatnot, and I figured that's something I would have a go at. Excuse me.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I'm not a planner. That's not something that I do. But the way I think I operate is I want something. If that's what I want to achieve, then I can see. You know, I'm not a great planner, but I can see that that's what I want. And then I just go for that. That's where all my energy goes, into that direction. And I don't know, it just, you know, people, I've had a lot of help from people. And, you know, I've definitely haven't done it on my own. You know, I've had a lot of people help me out. I've had a lot of friends, and also, you know, friends that have come and gone as well. So it's definitely been a process, and it hasn't happened overnight, but I've got this place to where, you know, it's work for me. You know, I come in here and I love doing it. I love being here. If there was no money in it, I'd still be doing it, is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Finding something, you know, I talk a lot about how, you know, athletes, especially that played as long as you did, you know, I didn't even play near that long. when we're in a play or in a game, it creates these real hypervigilant situations, you know, where we respond. You know, we're at the top of our senses, if you will, and we're reacting. Like you said, we target something and we go get that, whether it's a tackle or the ball or something. And I'm kind of writing about it now in the book I'm working on, but the idea of once we're done with that, not only do we lose the identity of, say, the football player, the rugby player, you know, the tennis player, even whatever, when we lose that, we are still kind of behaviorally trained to search for like those moments that give us that hyper vigilance, right? That give us that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of athletes turn MMA, et cetera, you know, and the drugs called to me like that. You know, there was that rush of, you know, even selling them and using them and that whole kind of that world. How much do you think maybe that could have played into the situations you were seeking kind of along the way?
I think it plays a huge part because, you know, going to training was a buzz, you know, for me. You know, it gave me that, just that natural high of being at training, being with friends. And then the game would come and it would just be kind of like this whole ritual of, you know, the day before the game, I would watch a certain show, and then the next day I'd wake up and I'd start watching The Simpsons and just trying to keep my excitement levels down, you know, but kind of ready to go, you know, kind of leading them into whatever time the game was. I'd kind of like time that hype. So, you know, you get that massive high of the game. And then, I mean, I remember looking around, you know, once I became more aware of it, was just sitting around and just looking around the room, and it's just the guys with the same look on their face, just kind of almost like down, you know, like depending if we won or lost. But even sometimes when we would win, it would be a great game, I'd just be sitting there and I'd be spent mentally and, you know, and emotionally and physically. And I think that has a big part to do with it, you know, because then afterwards, what would you do? You go out and drink all night, you know, with the boys to kind of calm the nerves or whatever, and you sort of come back down, and the next day you just cycle all over and over again, you know, every week, week in, week out. Australians as a whole, but I think definitely rugby league has got a huge culture of binge drinking. So that's something that went on a lot during the time that I played, and I'm pretty sure it still goes on, you know, today.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. You know, I even write a little bit in this book about, you know, the feeling of the Friday night lights that I felt when I played high school as compared to playing college, and those feelings, mm-hmm. and really, it's one-on-one battle. It's everything. It is. It's mental. It's like being in a fight for a while, and you know, the ritual of it, and losing that ritual of it, and then trying to find something that ever could compare to match what that is became something I mm-hmm. was looking for. You know, I couldn't find anything to match that. You know, I had to push the limits every time.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, that's it, man. Yeah. That's exactly it.
But nothing still compared. You know, you get a long ways. You know, even bullets missing you and stuff. Nothing peaks it. It's just a repetitive thing that you look for until you kind of become aware of what you're trying to do or where you're trying to fit. You know, and people do talk about it being a process. But you know, you were talking about that rock bottom moment, and then. It kind of makes me really think about, because I think people change in moments, that moment they decide. The rest is just what's happening after the change, kind of like the flower's going to bloom anyway, kind of. So that moment when you kind of hit the bottom and said, this is it. You know, for me, I hear that's the moment you actually change. The rest just kind of followed suit.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just that, it's that change of direction. When I look back on, you know, just my life in general, but especially over the last few years, it's you feel like, you know, obviously the world's round and you're just living your day-to-day life in that one direction. And then you have these moments where it's like God just takes his hand on the atlas and just spins it around, and everything's gone around, and you know you're putting claw marks and everything, trying to stay where you are because you think you're happy, or maybe you are happy and you don't want things to change. And you're just clawing at everything, and you're dragging everything in you. You're making everything so much more painful instead of just letting go, and then going in the direction, going off in a different direction to where you're meant to go. And then the world stops again. You can kind of steady your feet and just keep on walking that path. If that makes sense, that kind of analogy. That's how I've thought of things over the last few years, especially.
If anybody's been there, they know exactly what you said. Now, to somebody, I've been there. I know what you mean. Anybody that hasn't been there is like, they're still on drugs. What the fuck is wrong with you? No, but if you've been there, and yeah, I do. I know what you mean. I refer to my change moment in the book it's a movie called Forrest Gump. And it's the Lieutenant Dan moment where he ties himself to the top of the ship, you know, and they're out there in the storm and he's yelling at God, "This is all you got." I mean, I had that moment. It was a living room moment. It was like 16 hours for me. It's crazy. But that was that world spinning globe moment. What the heck's going on, you know? And you know, 2 years, you know, just go on walkabout after that. And for you, it was like this. How long ago was this that you kind of came? You said 4 years now. So it took you to
Yeah,
only
just
4 years
over 4 years.
to conquer basically addiction that you'd been battling really for 12 to longer years to even open up a gym. So it took you 15 years to get where you were when you were fucked up. And it only took you 4 years to own your own gym right now and be where you are.
You know, it's a big turnaround, and I still have some, I still have trouble kind of accepting kind of I guess credit. I think that it's just a byproduct of keeping my ego down here and my self-esteem up there, because always my life has always been ego here, my self-esteem ever since I was, as long as I can remember, my self-esteem like way down here, just I don't, for what reason I don't know, just was. And then it's slowly balanced out with it. I keep the ego down here and I keep my self-esteem up here. And that's, it's just, sometimes with, like when someone gives you credit for doing stuff, like, "Oh, you're great, you do this." I'm like, "Yeah, but not really." I try and play it off,
You
but
know
I
my
just,
favorite
I
line
just.
is when someone tells you that, my favorite line is, "I have my moments." That's it.
Yeah. You're right. That's, I'm going to steal that from you.
There you go. Hey, go ahead. No trademark. So,
Yeah, so it's
well, I noticed you post a lot on the Tribe of Change, some cerebral stuff, man. I mean, you do. You're obviously, called to doing a lot of things. And I would argue that, that I talk a lot about, we're never just humble, right? It's a something we practice. We practice trying to be humble. And when you start to actually get competent about things yourself, really, when you get self-competent or competent in life or just in general, that competence lets you know how much you don't fucking know. So as the competence gains, you're able to kind of practice the humility more so you can learn more. And then the more you learn, you realize the more shit, I don't know shit. And that humility keeps up, and you're like, man. So if I keep a lot of people, I think, stop wanting to learn more because the more you learn, the more you learn, you don't fucking know. So they're kind of like, look, this is what I know. This is what I believe. This is who I am. This defines me. Don't rock my fucking boat.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's a lot of, I've changed significantly. Especially over the last 12 months, I've been able to really keep evolving. Especially, I don't know, and I know Naudi is a friend, a mutual friend of ours. And that's, and doing FP has had a big hand in that kind of stuff. Just kind of taking, keep peeling the illusions away from, from in front of me. And it just keeps happening. The more and more I guess the more and more I stay true to myself and others, then the more I can just keep peeling away at all the bullshit that's out there. And there's a lot of it, and you said that I post a lot of stuff out there that can be deemed inflammatory to people that don't want to see that.
I said
that
I
kind
said
of stuff.
Cerebral, no inflammatory. I said cerebral.
Well, some people say inflammatory. So
yeah, that's why you're in the tribe of change. Everyone knows. Look, everyone knows, to every member of the tribe of change, you all know that I say it every time. Before you post something in that group, know your shit. Because I'm telling you, there's some cerebral people in there, and they're gonna. And what I love is people can call each other out on their own shit and have a good on there, exchange knowledge. No one's like, fuck you piece of shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, people, yeah.
You know, and sometimes I get lost in those comments on the tribe, and I'm like, holy, I just learned both sides of the argument very, very well. I'm like, I'm getting less nice now because of all those people in the tribe. And
yeah,
of
yeah.
course, inflammatory. All, I think we all are in the tribe.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, you know, I've had the pleasure of meeting quite a few good people. Like I said, through FP especially. You know, Matty Martin, I know he's been on the show a few times. At the, you know, I was very fortunate enough to meet him in Sydney when I was back there in September. So he's another guy that just kind of blows my mind as far as, you know, his knowledge of everything. You know, before that, I knew him through comments on, you know, on the Tribe of Change, and then I actually got to meet him. It was like, you know, just everything he says is thought out, and everything is questioned, and, you know, I'm like, shit, I got to come up with a good, I got to know something about whatever I'm talking about. So it's always good to have that BS detectors around you, because it makes you less inclined to kind of reach into that bag of I'm going to throw it out there.
I'm going to change the tagline to Tribe of Change, BS detector.
Mate, it is absolutely. Can't get away with much.
Yeah, not at all, man. But, you know, the thing with FP too is, like, there's no end to it, you know? It's just you dive in and there's constant learning. Constant process. Somebody's getting a shit kicked out of their mind.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
That's a short, you know, we can ask them to not trade. That was coming, huh?
Hey, I'll go to the back if you want.
Yeah, see if you can move, man. That's
yeah, man.
We're only about half an hour or something, man.
All right, man. I'll jump in the back.
Yeah, we'll wait. No worries. So, I mean, for everybody listening to this
update. How you doing, brother? You good?
Oh, yeah, I'm good. I'm just
nervous. That's good, man. It's all good. Sorry, I was just saying, get out of it.
Yeah.
My mate.
Yeah, the Tribe of Change is a Facebook group where you can join. It's closed, so you just got to find one of the moderators. So I try to add more moderators as it grows. You know, Steve does too. And anyway, so what we do on the podcast is, you know, from the Tribe of Change, I get suggestions from people. Nina Chow was doing it for a little while, but, trying to find those on the tribe that, you know, have a story or something to share. And, you know, I wanted to bring Shannon on and talk about it, that, you know, the overcoming of addiction is something I wanted him to move forward. You know, I didn't want him to, you know, that he wanted to was comfortable, but you notice I love how we covered it. And I didn't have to dive into all the other places healing or affected by addiction can take you. And if you notice, you know, Shannon went straight.
Yeah, mate.
Went through it.
It's my,
that's all right. I'm narrating you in, man. And Al Shannon went.
That's my makeshift studio right here.
That's the workout studio.
That's my makeshift studio right here. I've got a plyo box and I've got a crate. I'm all set.
Hey, trust me, man. I've made houses with less.
I bet you have.
Yeah, I was just kind of walking in, man, just updating people while you were walking out of, you know, about the Tribe of Change and how you were sharing your story. And if they could notice, you know, when you told your story, you didn't really dive into, like, the dark places. You didn't, you know, a lot of people that are telling a story that deal with addiction, I know, because A, I've been on one side of it, and I've also been a patient or a client, patient and a client, and a therapist on the inside, as we refer to it. But when the story is told, a lot of times I used to tell it with this very dramatic, detailed story. And then again, one of my comments I used to say is the devil's in the details, right? So the more you stay in the details, well, that's technically the kind of shit you're dealing with, right? Lawyers, used car salesmen, and the devil hang out in the details. And they play you around there, right? So when you learn to kind of step out of the details, and when you told your story, you avoided those dark details and kind of, you know, jumped to what worked for you, you know, and you did it with a, you know, with a humble approach too, right? You tried to stay away from it. And I just see how that keeps adding to your growth, man, and what you're doing. And I mentioned in the beginning, now you're trying to, you're going back to Australia now?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've got a 12-year-old daughter, in Sydney. And, you know, when I left, and it was, I don't regret, you know, what's happened in my life. I regret people that have hurt, you know, and that's, you know, it's all part of it, making, you know, making amends and seeing that, you know, you kind of do what I do what I can to, you know, right, you know, the wrongs that I've done. But, you know, it's, I left for the right reason, but, you know, I regret hurting people, and she's definitely the one, that was probably affected the most. And I just, you know, it was no question when I came back from Australia this time, and I went, I spent a few weeks with Naudi and the FP crew and my daughter as well. And I can't be away from her anymore. It's just, it's not even a question about it. It didn't matter. I love it here. I've met a lot of good people, that have helped me change. And then, you know, I've been able to help them change in some ways. But at the end of the day, you know, that's my daughter and that's my blood. And I can't be without her, anymore. And I think that I'm ready to go back and be the dad she deserves. You know what I mean? Like I'm there now. It's time, you know, and maybe 6 months ago, maybe it wasn't, but it's time now. And it's something I've been thinking about for a few years. You know, it just gets to that point where, you know, like I said, everything starts spinning and changing, and then you just got to let go. And, but I know where I need to be. I know where I should be, and that's it.
And remember, you know, when you go back, that it's never too late to ever go back for any parent out there, or someone that's distant from somebody. You know, coming back, it's better now than longer. You know, you could have not come back. You could have waited 2 more years. You could have waited till she was 20. And the fact that, you know, you're here now and present then, you know, as you do go back, realize as you're making that transition with her that she may be a little protective of herself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something you're going to want her to be, you know. And truth be told, when I was first getting to know Morgan before I adopted her, I was so proud of her because she waited almost a year and a half before she really even let me in. Mm-hmm. And it showed me how strong she was. You know, she had made herself, you know, pretty strong emotionally about how much she would let herself connect. And I never pushed that connection with her. You know, I let that evolve with her. And years later, now she is mine. She has my last name in the whole nine. And it's a delicate come together. And just keep that in mind, that if she is defensive, you may, you know, be proud of her for that, because that's her being strong. And just ease your way in there as soft and light as you can, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I absolutely. I 100% agree with you there. There was a little resistance, you know, when I went back, and she was a little guarded, and it just, you know, it took a, you know, week or so for us to really connect again. But once we did, you know, that was it. You know, we had a ball, man. We had the best time ever. And, you know, I just want to have more times like that. And she's, you know, she's starting high school next year. She's self-sufficient, man. She catches a bus everywhere, and she does this and she does that. She hangs with the friends, and can you take me here? And I'm like, yeah. You know, I think when she first said, oh, can I stay over at so-and-so's house? And in my head, immediately, I was like, well, I'm not here that often. And then I'm like, yeah, you're not here that often. She's got a fucking life, man. She's got a, you know, she does stuff, you know. She's kind of, you know, she's got her own life. And she's moved on and does things, you know, in her own time. So, you know, it was just that one moment. I was like, you know, she was letting me know that she's a big girl, but, you know, at the same time, I had to recognize that that's, she's grown. She's not, you know, she's not a little girl anymore. She's becoming a young woman. And, you know, it's the first time I've been a father. So I'm just going to be doing everything I can to, I don't know, just be there for her. Just be there for her.
Listen.
That's all that. That's all there is.
Listen, you know? Yeah. Just listen, man. One of the hardest things to do, just listen, you know, listen and watch and be there, you know that, you know, the safety she's going to love, the protection she's going to love, you know, ask questions. It's okay. You know, ask more questions than you do statements. I'm just telling you what works for me. I'm not saying that this shit may fuck you up. I don't know. I got a disclaimer here, man. I'm just telling you, it's just me. So I'm just listen and ask a lot of questions, man. You know, I try not to judge. I try to listen. I inform more than I do anything, you know, rather than argue.
Yeah,
I would inform and just watch. But that's a beautiful thing, man, to listen to. Oh, man, is. I don't know. Does being the father like that beat being the rugby player that game day?
Yeah, it's not even a question. I've done some great. You know, I've had some great achievements. You know, in whatever career that I had. Really big moments and had success over here with my gym and whatnot. But this doesn't even compare. Like She's the best thing that I've ever had a hand in. I won't say that I've done because obviously that wasn't just me, but you know it's by far, hands down. There's no question about it.
And you know what? There's no harmful side effects.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. So it's the best thing there is.
Yeah. No better high. No harmful side effects. And nothing but love for it, man. I mean. That's the story of overcoming, if you ask me, of beating it. I don't think you're an addict, man. I think you're affected by addiction slowly, as many people are, especially many athletes. We're raised to be titans. We become who we are. We judge ourselves by our performance. Our value is then correlated to our performance. Then we take our title. We can no longer perform. We lose value.
Mm-hmm.
We've been in pain for 5 to 10 years. We've been taking pills, and it moves to give me that juice.
Mm-hmm.
Man, you came through it in 4 years. That's what I love most, man. I think people, you know, they talk a lot about the change process and they see it as this long road. And I mean, I write in the book too. I'm like, look, it's 25 years to get to this point, 5 years to get out. I like those fucking odds. You know what I mean? I'll take it. And yours are what, 12, 15 years one way, 4 years to be out and be in some place totally you may not have imagined 3 years, 4 or 5 years ago.
Absolutely not. You know, the stuff that I thought I wanted 4 years ago or even a year ago, definitely not the stuff that I want now. It's ever changing and it's always evolving, which I love. I mentioned, you know, being in a certain place and just wanting to be there. I say, okay, I'm good. I don't want anything to move. Everyone stay where they are. This is exactly what I want. And then it all changes and I would always lose my mind, you know, and I'd go crazy. But now it's like things start to change and I just let go and I'm like, okay, wait for everything to stop spinning. All right, then I'm just going to walk this way now until that happens again. So that's definitely a tool that I've used to combat that kind of trying to control situation. Trying to control the situation came up recently with me. And I was in a funk for days, you know. I was definitely in a funk for days, and I think I had my mindset that this was, you know, something was going to happen. Something was going to happen by a certain date, and it didn't end up happening by that certain date. So the more I went over that date, I was getting frustrated, and I was getting kind of egotistical. You know, there's kind of crazy thoughts popping up in my head, and you know, I'm just. Nonsense. And I've been doing a lot of Wim Hof method, you know, and meditating a lot. Like I'll do that every day and I'll do it for as long as I can every day. And, you know, I did that, you know, an hour or two. And then I, you know, I just texted, you know, the people involved. And I'm like, look, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry I've been out of my mind lately. And I wasn't really overboard, but I was just kind of being pushy in situation. And I, I texted him. I said, "Look, man, I'm so sorry that, you know, this is not how I behave. I think I just, it was, we had a date set for this and it went over, and I was trying to control the situation instead of just letting it happen when it was going to happen. Because no matter what I did, it wasn't going to change the timeline." So it's just me constantly learning, still learning to, it's like training. It's, you know, it's like training anything, training your body, training your muscle, training your mind. It's training to do, to when I'm in certain situations, to think in a certain way. Like when at the start, when I said I was so messed up that anything I did, my first thought or reaction to do, I just did the complete opposite. Now I'm, you know, I've got the tools to use to what I think is the right decision at the time. And for the better part of it, you know, I'm happy with the way I behave. But sorry, I just went off on a rant there. But it still pops up, you know, now and again. You know, I don't need drugs to be crazy or, you know, paranoid. So, you know, because I think I'm pretty intuitive with a lot of things. So, you know, sometimes there's times where I don't know if I'm just paranoid, if it's my intuition, which is...
No, we just live in a crazy world, man. And the more you... I was arguing this, and, you know, the day I was doing a rampage and I didn't have my notes, but I was saying that, look, there's no such thing as paranoia when you're either smoking or anything else, because... Only when you get more competent and you learn about things, you start to realize what a crazy, dangerous fucking place we live in. Mm-hmm. And it's not that you're paranoid, it's you're fucking awake. And
yeah.
So, I mean, look, it's not paranoid when you smoke and drive. It's just because you're realizing you're in a 2,100 or 1,200 pound machine doing 90, trusting a lot of human beings around you at once. You know, and you're like, I don't even trust my neighbor. And I don't even know this guy doing 85 next to me right now. You know what I mean? Now you just become more aware. And I say, man, when you get more competent about self, when you get self-competent, when you learn more about the world and around you, you know, that awareness increases. And I think with the awareness is what you're kind of talking about, is you're aware of your response. You're able to slow it down. Leo used to tell me, you know, you let certain things flow through you, certain things flow around you.
Yep.
You know, even if they flow through you, you can still grab them, think about what you're thinking, and process that in a rational manner.
Absolutely. Absolutely makes sense. Yeah, I'm hearing you.
But you're doing that all on your own, man. I mean, I love the Cochran story, dude, and the continual story. It's not like, and you know, you talked about direction a lot. And sometimes I, just to get people to think, I talk about, look, I don't believe in goals, right? I'll say something real hardcore like that. Mm-hmm. And it's really just to say, look, if I set a goal C and I'm at life A, I'm basically saying I can control what happens in life B. And I may miss something in life B when I'm so focused on getting to C.
Mm-hmm.
And goals really should be more of a direction. And I think for you, it seems like a direction became get to my daughter. However that happens, that became the direction. And you really didn't necessarily, like you said, have a goal to open a gym or anything. You just said, get to my daughter, and this became a path that was the fastest for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You bang on the money. That's how I see it. You know, it's always been something that's on my mind, you know, as soon as I left. And it's, you know, it's taken as long as it was supposed to take, you know, for me to get to this point and for me to be, you know, who I am now. And I think that's more, I think if I went back any sooner, it might not be as beneficial, you know, to both of us, but especially her, you know, and my friends and family as well. I mean, my friends and family love me unconditionally, and they, you know, they've loved me through all that craziness. And, you know, it's made me appreciate them much, much more. Because I a lot of my life I was very unappreciative, taking things for granted, and just, I guess, kind of living in a superficial existence for so long, where everything was handed to me, that, you know, the close people around you kind of take for granted a little bit, or you don't appreciate them as much. So now I see them and I think about them, or I text them and I tell everyone I love them, because I fucking do. You know, I don't just you know, some people think, you know, guys going, oh, I love you, man. It's just people like, I know there's, you know, a lot of friends that, especially footy players, you know, they think it's a kind of stigma to say that. But, you know, if you played a certain sport, you know that there's that love there. But I think I've been able to manifest more of that. So the more I put out there, the more I get. It's just, it's just a cycle of energy that I'm able to put out there, and it just keeps coming back, and it keeps getting stronger and stronger, and bigger and bigger. And, you know, the more people that are that I'm allowed to become involved with, and blessed enough to have in my life.
Yeah, the social support is huge, and I want to get a little specific before we end the podcast, man, to give some a little specifics for people. And I want to go ahead and reference, let's say we're through, you know, someone has gone through kind of the rehab part, they're off the medications if they were on them, they're out of the halfway house, if you will, it's themselves, and it's kind of like that first week where it's kind of on your own. What was some of the strategies you put in that kind of week to help keep you on track? What did you do? Take me through like your typical day or so that helped you stay focused, you know, at that point.
I never went into a treatment facility. I just went to a meeting. You know, I just started going to meetings every day. And I think I just started doing that. Like I kept away from everything that I was, that I had known, you know, any situations that were going to be inflammatory or, you know, going to be reactive, I would always stay well away. I was able to do that. And I think when I spoke before about seeing, you know, when I would go to places and meetings and talk to other addicts, I would, you kind of sizing people. I mean, I think human beings in general, very judgmental, but addicts are very judgmental. It's just like anything to pick someone apart, you know, you'd always, I guess my self-esteem was always so low. I'd always like to pick out other people's defects or whatever I thought they were, just to kind of make me feel better about myself. But I would, that's, you know, some people say don't judge, but you have to judge when you're in that situation. You have to source out the people that have got some good time, some good clean time, and seem like they got this shit together. And just watch what they do, talk to them and be honest. I mean, I think that was one of the parts of why I was able to have success, you know, up until now.
So you were socially connected to people that were going through what you were going through. That's extremely important.
Yes.
And from like your day-to-day schedule, obviously you could be at meetings all the time, but you went to a few, but throughout the day, what would you focus on? What did you do? What were some activities that you took part in to fill the rest of that time?
I would just work, you know, just work on my fitness, or just trying to learn new things, and try and do good things, try and be with people that make you happy. And, make them happy, you know, do your best, do what you can to give them some kind of joy. And that was more than enough to keep me happy. I never once thought of going to get high or going down the pub for a drink. I never ever thought of doing that. I guess cause I kept my mind busy trying to do the complete opposite of what I would always do. I would say change something about you that you've always done. For me, it was like biting my fingernails, which is gross as shit. But ever since I was a kid, since I was five, who knows how long, that was something that I always did. I always chewed my nails, always, and like all the way down, just constantly. I would always have that kind of nervous, that nervous habit. It was gross, but from the first day, from the first day I got clean, from my clean day, I said, that's it. No more chewing your nails. And I haven't, and it's been, you know, over 4 years. But that was something I'd done my entire life, not just since I was using. It was something that I'd always done. So, because the drugs are just a symptom of the disease that's going on underneath, whatever's going on, whatever's causing that, that's just a symptom. of you know, of trying to suppress, you know, whatever it was, you know.
Damn.
I had to change. I had to change something significant in my, I think in my mind, that I had always done that I had to stop doing. And that was, and that was it for me. I mean, like they're a little long now. And I was, last night I was sitting there looking at them, like, oh, and I'm like, you know, it doesn't worry me anymore. But I'm like, oh, I got to cut those before. I might like, just one day just be sitting there, you know. So I guess it's, if I'm staying on top of my nails, then I'm staying on top of my shit.
Hey, look, what that is, man, that's conquering a behavioral pattern. And so you talked about an environmental and a social reconstruction. You chose something behaviorally to change, which is what you did with your extra time, what you did in your nervous anxiety time. Put that with meditation. You focused on your biology and your health and made sure that was on point. And you were already focusing on changing how and what you were thinking and the story you were telling.
Yes. Yeah. That's it. I mean, that's the best advice that I, that, you know, if anything that I could give, it's to just change, you know. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to be one of those people that's just,
when you know the what? Day that, I left something out. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I left something out, which is the hardest fucking thing you did. You questioned you and who you were at the very beginning. You didn't keep saying, that's just who I am. You questioned that. That was the hardest thing you did. Then you did all the rest. The hardest thing you did was say, wait, what am I doing? What do I really believe? You started there, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's just a question who you get to, I think, you know, well, me, I can't say for everyone, but for me, just got to that point where I was like, I don't want to be like this. And it's not like, oh, this is who I am. I'm just a piece of shit, which I did, you know. But, you know, eventually got to the point where I'm like, that's just a cop out. That's just an absolute cop out. And, you know, that's bullshit. It's not just who I am. Yeah, I was a piece of shit. Now I'm less of a piece of shit. So, you know, it's just getting further and further away from that existence. You know, and I'm not perfect, you know, at all. You know, definitely not. And, you know, I mess up here and there, and but you know what? As long as I stay clean, then you know, sometimes I'll have a shitty day, and like, so I know for me that would never having a shitty day would never trigger those thoughts that I, you know, that I should go out and use the tools that I would use that would just like, okay, calm down, the world's not ending. Don't, you know, don't sit on the pity pot too long. Don't feel sorry for yourself, which I'm...
You mean you, you did cognitive reconstructuring. You actually, you changed your thoughts.
Yes, yes, yes. I just had to, like, get with it and say, okay, you're just having a shitty day. Why sometimes? I just felt like shit. And I would just feel like shit, feel like this, go to bed early, wake up the next day. It's a totally different day. And have another crack at it, you know. And if you feel like shit, then that's maybe, oh, you've got two bad days out of how many good days. It, you know, it's not even close to, you know, on the whole, but, you know, life's really good. It's great, you know. I've got a lot to be grateful for. And if I have days where I'm kind of feeling like really, you know, bummed out, then I just like, well, you stayed clean today, you didn't use, and I'm like, yeah, that's enough.
And that's definitely enough. You didn't bite your nails.
Yeah, and I didn't bite my nails. That's right.
Hey, man, thanks for coming on and sharing. You know, that's an uplifting story for me, for sharing your rampage, man.
Oh, man, I'm glad I can help. I'm glad I can help, mate. Thanks for having me on.
No, anytime, and we'll keep chatting on the Tribe of Change, man.
All right, brother.
Any love to anybody you want to shout out or where they can find you or anything like that?
Oh, man, just, mate, love out to everyone. You know, it's... you know, we're all out here to try and help each other out, you know. And I guess society, or you know, whatever the powers that be, have kind of got us pitted against each other to choke each other out and take what the other person's got. But it doesn't have to be like that, you know. We ultimately, we're here to help each other out, you know. And I think the more people we get thinking like that, instead of the old way where we've been brainwashed to think that we, you know, we need to be standing over our opposition or our neighbors with our foot on their throats. I think the more people we start to change that perspective, then I think we're just going to get more momentum with, you know, with the cause and with the tribe. It's the Tribe of Change. So you know, if this help, if this has helped anyone, you know, I'm able to help my clients. Some of my clients have problems, or they know a person or a family member of theirs that has issues with that as well. Just reach out to anyone. You know, it's, there's no harm in reaching out at all. So if you're umming and ahhing, just put the hand out or just ask a question. Simple.
Man, there's a good little cognitive rampage at the end too. Yeah. Good, man. I appreciate that, man. Thanks again, Shannon, man.
No worries, brother. Take it easy.
All right, bro. I'll see you on internet space.
All right, bro.
Later. Well, I enjoy having any member from the Tribe of Change on like that, that is, you know, sharing their story of overcoming, you know, and changing their life and doing something different. You know, I didn't know the daughter part was in that story. I like to not know too much, you know, and walk in and to find out 12 years, 15 years in rugby and losing that and how addiction came on, that it didn't come from necessarily trauma in his life, that he went through things, but kind of crept on because it came on with the game and all of it kind of combined, that there's not necessarily this direct cause of addiction, that really it can be a storm, if you will, of many things that lead that way, that it can creep on. It doesn't have to be something traumatic maybe happened to you, or maybe that was the tipping point, you know, but I think where addiction comes from, I think becomes less important sometimes than what are you going to do to not be affected by addiction, you know, and make that change. And you see, Shannon didn't even go to a rehab. You know, my hat's off again to a 12-step program or a meeting or social meetings being offered there. You know, it helps people for sure, you know, and Shannon added other things in other ways to his life. You know, there's a lot of paths and a lot of ways. And that's what I talk about in the Rampage is, you know, I don't show you the way in this book. You know, I kind of pull together tools, research, it's science-based, structured-based. You know, we talked about the four levels of change that Shannon went through. Those are the four levels that I approach, you know, in here. But I kind of just give you a framework, really. You pick it. You're going to analyze what you believe, write down your thoughts. So it's all you. It's not like me saying, here's the way, here's the path, you know, follow me, I'll make you rich in 30 days. You know, that's not what it's about. But it's change needs to occur on all fronts. It can't just occur if you change the way you think, sure. But if your environment stays the same, eventually it will overcome you. You can definitely change the perception of your environment, which is very strong, but it's hard to maintain that. So the environment has a huge effect. So you got to change the environment. And that's the people around you. That's the things that you do. That's an internal environment too, even down to what you wear, what you listen to, you know. You got to be willing to kind of remove all that. You know, when I used to work in a clinic, I'd tell people, if you had cancer and the doctor was removing the tumor, maybe it was cancerous, right? There's just a tumor, right? I don't want to get dark. And would you tell the doctor to say, hey, you know what? I want you to leave about 0.01% of that in there. Of course not, right? We wouldn't say that. So when I tell people to try to change your lives completely or change a cycle that's repetitive, you got to be willing to get rid of your favorite music. You got to be willing to dump everything else because even if, you know, when you play that one song, it reminds you of Friday night or that one person, right? It can trigger emotion. But, you know, even if it does or doesn't, or that person that I tell you in the book, I actually tell you to use my rule of two, which is every two people, person, place, or thing removed from anything associated with what you want to change has to go for a while. Because even if it's just a little bit, that little bit of cancer can grow back really quickly into something big. So you got to be willing to change everything environmentally. Start analyzing the way you think, not being critical about what you think or what you believe. Understand that you can create different perceptions. Use stories of trauma to actually be powerful. You know, we can tell a story that's dramatic, that I've been through all this, and that's why I'm an addict. Or we can say I've been through a traumatic thing and I've been through all this and all that, and that's why I'm now a speaker. That's now why I talk to kids. That's why I now wrote a book. You can change that. So how we tell our story, what the narrative is, what you believe, that's the cognitive front. So cognitive, environmental, then behavioral, what you do can also affect how you think and especially what you feel. So your environment can affect what you do. So by changing the environment, he said, learning new things, getting competent, chasing the competence in different things. There's so much. We never stop learning, right? When we were a kid, our favorite word was why. Why? Why is it blue? Why is this hot? Why? Then somewhere along the line, we got arrogant and say, well, we fucking know everything. Well, we don't. Get curious again about yourself. Stop saying that's just who I am. Open up to what you could be. The human potential in itself is priceless, right? So when you open that up, when you begin to ask why again, when you explore yourself, when you change periods to question marks about self, others, and the world, when you can explore it, you can get competent, right? Then you learn, holy man, I don't know anything. I don't know who I am. This is how we open up change. This is where we change on an essence level, right? That's a cognitive, environmental, but that's behavioral. So what we do, if you wake up every day, you're taking care of your body, or you're into something else physical, right? You got to hit the biology too. The health matters. When you structure something different, that's where TSBT comes from, is transrational structure behavior theory. Structuring behavior based with rational thought, transitioning to a rational frame of thinking while implementing structured behaviors for purpose. Not that we have a purpose, but I purposely do this at this time because of this. We structure that purposefully. That's how you make change. It's on all fronts. It's not a little this or a little that. You have to be willing to let go of all of it and make that change. And Shannon did that. You know, he left. He had to leave everything behind. And that's tough to do. You know, optimization can occur without full change. But anyway, the second revision to the Cognitive Rampage, or I will say the only way you'll be able to buy this edition of the Cognitive Rampage again is up until about January something. And we're never going to see this printed again. So if you own this book, it's technically limited edition once the second revision comes out, but you won't be able to purchase the first edition anywhere unless you buy it used after sometime in January. That's also when the audiobook will come out. So I did read the audiobook, and in the audiobook there's editions, and I'm not reading this book on the audiobook. That's why it's a little delayed, is I've already read this book on audio, but now I got to re-record for the revised edition. I'm going to record that one. And on the audiobook, I tend to, if you can imagine, scroll off sometimes and I go into little tangents that relate to what the book was about, etc., that aren't in the book. So that will be available in January, I hope, sometime, along with the second revision of the Cognitive Rampage. Drink my Coty. My bad, Alfred. I haven't been able to do the intros to the podcast because I've been traveling a lot, but so I wanted to kick one at the end. I took like 17 of these MyCoTs with me when I travel. Order it. Just go to drinkmycoty.com. Look it up. Just order it. It's the cleanest water you can find. It'll do good things for you. It can relax you. I would drink this at the end of a work day. Kind of relaxes me and mellows me out. But the guy that was traveling with me, Sean, my friend, he would drink it while working and it kind of kept him focused. So, but it's all organic, natural stuff. You're good. Go to drinkmycoty.com. Love it. Told you about the book. Dollar Mental Health Club is coming back soon. Probably January, February. We have a new development. We're moving into our last test. We were launching Dollar Mental Health Club in June and launched our beta test and did well with it. We liked it. And so now there's a new model being implemented. So we have to run another test with Dollar Mental Health Club sometime in January. And we'll have a little new look, a few new things that we're doing. But remember, I'm trying to change the paradigm of mental health is what I'm trying to do. 60% of America does not have insurance. So to see a mental health therapist or to see even a life coach, it can be expensive. A lot of mental health counselors that are licensed don't take insurance anymore. So there are 100, 150 to see. Or maybe you do have insurance and it's still 30, 40, 50 bucks to see somebody. And it may be months out. So for me, we can't say that mental health is equal to physical health if the insurance plans don't really match what the laws say they should. And so that helps not out there. And there's tons of counselors and people out there looking for to help people. But the structure and the way to get to that help is difficult through all these insurance mazes and shit. So with the paradigm shift of Dollar Mental Health Club, I'm trying to change that. We're trying to make mental training, practicing in the present, right? We're not going into diagnosis. We're not going into crisis management. We're not going into the childhood. We're talking about giving strategies in the present, doing in short spurts. We call you. So it's not like you got to go to an office. You don't have to sit in a waiting room. You set the appointment. You pick it, pick the counselor, pick the trainer that we have on there. We'll have specialists, et cetera, and pick that. And then we call you at the time or whoever you select will. So Dollar Mental Health Club's coming back. So just stay tuned with that. It's on the way. We just got to do it right. Got to do testing. Got to do the back ends. Got to pay the lawyers, right? It's a slow build. But when you build a foundation, you know, on good, solid, you know, stone, it can build right. If you build it on the sand, right, we'd be screwed up. So you got to go slow. We're also trying to bring something new. So you will see Dollar Mental Health Club coming back. The second revision of that, drinking some Myco tea. I hear stories like Shannon, I get hyped because they're just, it's exciting because I get excited for you listening or anybody else that you could sit there in that moment and just decide in this moment. Now it's different. It changes today. We do this differently. And it does. And it does, because what you believe happens now is simply that, because you believe it because you think you've experienced it. But if you ride a roller coaster and you tell me it wasn't scary and I ride it and I say it was, who's telling the truth? Truth is perception, and you can define that perception any way you want to, as long as the negative perception doesn't define you. You can change anything, man, or woman, or whatever. Yeah. I have a podcast that I did while in New Orleans. Try to cover them all. When I was there, holy shit, this will trip you out too. I'm not going to tell the whole story because the podcast is kind of different. The podcast is only about 7 minutes long, and I'm going to post that podcast as like 1:16. So it's coming. I don't have it on video, so I just have the audio. But when we do release this, it's 7 minutes where, let's just say, two young boy, military, 20-year-old kids from a small town in Mississippi explain to me what the brochure said when they signed up and what really was happening to them in the next few weeks. It blew me away. It blew me away. It's a crazy 7 minutes, but anyway, you'll even listen to this lady on there change her tune when she thinks that she's being recorded. And I asked her if it would make a difference if these were military. In the response, it was funny to watch the political correctness shape who she was real fast. But anyway, that's on there. It's a crazy 7 minutes. But we're going to put that out. It's probably 1:16 or something. And actually, I may have a podcast coming on tonight. I'm not sure if he's going to be able to make it up to the cave. So he may or may make it. But on the 8th, on December 8th, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Florida MMA legend. He's a guy in Florida MMA, from schools to booking fighters. He is a promoter. He is one of the few very successful promoters in the state of Florida when it comes to promoting MMA matches, both pro and amateur. So Dan Donaldson is going to come on. He's going to be in the cave. Hopefully he's trying to drive up from down south. Maybe we'll see him in the cave live on the 8th, or we may come virtually, but Dan will come on. I've been getting into local MMA a lot. Zach Moore, awesome friend, who was how I met Dan. And I met Zach, I think, through Julian, my soon-to-be UFC fighter boy, Julian Jace Move Williams. But I met Zach. Zach just he's taken off. He's been on the doctor's program. Zach has done this amazing body transformation, so he's been busy. So, you know, Dan's going to come on and talk about what it's like being in the MMA world so long on a local scene and on a national scene. He's done fights overseas as well. He's done fights in the Bahamas, you know. So what's it like promoting successful events? What's it been like coming up? He was a fighter too at one point. So I hung out with Dan and Zach after one of their fights. They let me be a judge, which is really cool. I've judged a few times, and we hung out afterwards and just talked MMA for a while. So looking forward to learning from Dan, talking to Dan. So he'll be on soon, but I hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. Love you.